So the quality of our work depends on the story we inhabit on the job. The quality of our work depends on the story we inhabit on the job. And by quality, I'm contrasting that with quantity, you know, with just being productive. So there's a sense it refers to excellence. But it's also about meaning. Like, work has a quality to it. What's it mean? What's its purpose? And even beyond that, I want to stretch it a little bit and say quality of life. You know, the quality of life we find in our work depends on the story we inhabit in the job. So the title this morning is Working in a Better Story. And by work, I mean really technically work is any area of our lives where we exert effort to produce results. So if you're a parent, that's work. Of course, you already knew that, right? And if you're a volunteer, that counts as work. But kind of in the center of the bullseye this morning is paid work. It's in that space where we exert effort for compensation. It's that arena of our lives where I think most of us will spend more waking hours over the course of our lives than in any other. And so we're suggesting we can work in a better story. And I think I'm swimming upstream this morning. It's Memorial Day weekend. It's a holiday. Do we really have to talk about work? I mean, can we go back to last week? For those of you who weren't here, the title of the message was sex last week. So we go from sex to work. I mean, and then there's some issues with the messenger. As some of you know, I'm from Pennsylvania, and most of you are from somewhere. But I'm from a special part of Pennsylvania. It's the border between the Philly metro area and the interior of Pennsylvania, which some of you know is affectionately called Pennsyltucky. And so, you know, what do we know about work? And then I live in New York now, but I live in Queens. And never mind that Long Island City is the fastest growing high-rise neighborhood in the United States. Doesn't matter. It's still across the river, I understand. And probably the biggest liability I bring with me up here this morning is that I'm a professional Christian. I was a pastor for 20 years. I worked for a Christian nonprofit. And as a very outspoken gynecologist pointed out to me a year or so ago, he said, "Oh, you're one of those guys that really doesn't do real work. You just suck off the work of others." So that's was his assessment of the situation. So three strikes against me. But two thoughts just to push back a little bit. The first is that actually I work on work. That's what I spend most of my time doing. It builds on decades of experience of talking to friends, of pastoring people in this critical area of their lives. And now I spend my time helping people find and follow their calling. That's what I do, you know, 24/7 with people who live and work here in New York. And so I spend a lot of time on that. And it's just possible that maybe I've gleaned something along the way that's worthwhile. But more personally, I struggle with work. I can't stop. You know, one of the beautiful things about New York is you can blame it for everything. No, it's New York. And I thought, well, I work all the time. It's New York. And my wife pointed out to me that, no, this has not been the case, that this is my own issue. Our daughter, Abby, had her 19th birthday in May 4th, and Audrey has a journal and was rehearsing the day, the circumstances of Abby's birth. So the water broke at 4 a.m. So those of you who have a child know what that means, right? So you have to get the bag, and you have to get in the car, and you have to take the two-year-old and wake up a grandparent, and you got to get to the hospital, which is 45 minutes away. So my wife kindly reminded to me that in the course of all those important tasks to get to the hospital in time to have the baby, I suggested that we stop at my office. Because I needed to give my assistant a list of things to do since I wouldn't be in that day. I'm like, I said that? I knew. I don't remember it. I blacked it out, but I know it's true. And I guess we didn't have email in 1998 in Pennsyltucky, so I had to settle for a voicemail. But I did. That's what I did. And that was what I was thinking about. So I have a problem with work, and I can't stop. And, you know, I think that some of us, and some of you in the room, you're in the church world or the nonprofit space. It's really interesting because officially, professionally, we're about one story. But we often work in another. We work out of another. And so we're messed up with work, just like the rest of you. So that's where we're going today. I'm going to take it in four parts. I want to make a case that we really do live out of story, out of a sense of story. And so I'll spend a little bit of time on that. And I want to talk about the dominant story that we interface with and work out of, I think, you know, in our space here. It's not just in New York, it's really everywhere. I want to talk about a life-giving alternative story, and then I want to close with switching stories. So, case that we live out a story. Second is the dominant story that we live out of at work, an alternative life-giving story, and then switching stories. So we live out a story. We live out a story. It's the idea that whether it's really clear or conscious or not, that our lives are hooked into a narrative that gives them a sense of context. And I was at a symposium in Midtown, I don't remember when it was a little while ago, and Dr. James Smith from Calvin College, philosophy professor, was talking about this idea that we, so it must be really important because the voice cracked, sorry about that. This idea. He's talking about this idea that we all have a story that gives our lives reference, even if we don't want to acknowledge it or aren't aware of it. And he suggested that your imagination is the part of you that anchors your life in a story. So your imagination is not just the part, that fanciful part that could imagine the sky being pink and flowers as big as skyscrapers. Your imagination is what he defines it as, your intuitive feel for the world. And that it's rooted in a story whether you know it or not. And that struck me as a brilliant way to say it. And I just started to think about it. And I think it's really true. And here's some examples. I think the story that we're in, that our imagination is hooked to, I think it's the reason that some people leave the city. Have you noticed that people leave the city? Like two or three of your friends every week tell you they're moving. And one of the exit ramps that is kind of textbook is that when you move from having one kid to two or three, or like when the family thing really kicks into high gear. And there's a lot of reasons for that. People say, well, the city's expensive and it's crowded and there's this and there's that. And those are the facts. But there's a story side to it too. And I really think it's this. I think that in our imaginations, when we picture family, we have a suburban picture, most of us. We have a picture of a house and a yard and a golden retriever and an eco-friendly SUV. That's family life. And so that doesn't fit easily into a Manhattan high-rise. And it's not about research, it's not about facts, it's about the story that we have and this picture that we have and what it's supposed to look like. And so we leave, we take the exit. You know, the Bible is always trying to invite people into a sense of a different story. And there's this flow to it. There's this idea that God is a creator who's initiated and brought about the world, that he's involved in the world and he's just and he's loving, and that we need to go through a process where we actively enter into his story. And so like in Ephesians 2, you'll see Paul saying, you were once aliens, you were once without hope in the world, but now you've become part of the family of God. You've entered into a new story with a new heritage. Peter uses similar language when he says, used to not be a people, but now you're God's people. You used to not be a nation, but now you're his. And so there's a sense of story that kind of anchors people in reality. And in American culture, we think similarly. In this little book by Andrew Del Blanco, who's at Columbia, he talks about, it's called The Real American Dream, and he talks about three stories that have anchored us in our culture. And the first story was a God story. It was the idea that the first explorers and settlers, most of them, came here to serve God, and it was a real, sincere thing, even though they had terrible blind spots and prejudices, some of them. And so that's why they came here. They came here to set up a new society that would connect with God and honor God. That's all the settlers, of course, except for the ones that came to New York, because they just came here to make money. That's why the Dutch came. But that's the anomaly that proves the rule. But he says the first kind of story was this God story. The second story was of, he calls it civil religion. It was build the nation, and it went from the Civil War to 1960. And he says this has been replaced by a new narrative, and it's the narrative of self-fulfillment. And so God and country are only valuable to me in as much as they serve my ongoing journey of self-fulfillment and actualization. And so that's his story. But all voices, whether it's the people leaving New York or it's the biblical story or it's a cultural analysis, we live out a story. We live out a story. So what is the story that we live out of when we go to work? What is your imagination hooked to as you enter that space. You know, what kind of world do you imagine when you go off to your job, when you enter wherever it is, whether it's you walk from the living room into the home office, or you get on the train or take the Uber or go somewhere, whatever it is, what kind of reality are you imagining? I'd like to suggest this morning that the reality you enter when you go to work is decidedly secular. That God is absent from that reality. That whether you know it or not, and say you believe in God and come to church and all these things, and I do too, that if you could really paint a picture of the world as you see it, it's a world where you're on your own. You are fundamentally alone, and the responsibility falls on you to figure it out, to make it happen, to make the right moves at the right time, to sift through the piles of information and opportunities and pick the ones that are really going to work and ignore the ones that won't. You're kind of like a spiritual orphan, just trying to make your way on your own. There's no God there. No personal God who cares and engages. It's up to you on your own. It's a decidedly secular vision of reality. The irony is that you could work for a Christian organization, and as soon as prayer time's over, you just click right into it. You click right into the same mindset. So where did this come from? Back to Dr. Smith. So Jamie wrote a book called How Not to Be Secular, which is a guide to this book called Our Secular Age by the philosopher Charles Taylor. I bought this book and I read this book. So he says two things that are helpful for us. First, he says that this is not an age of certainty, it's an age of doubt. That every story, every narrative is treated with skepticism. And so part of what's stressful and exhausting about our day is that we're just constantly placed with alternative stories, and there's something wrong with every single one. So which one do you pick? And in that kind of give and take, he says, Smith of Taylor says, there's a gravitational pull to what he calls the secular perspective, which crams reality into this thing called the imminent frame. So imagine a picture frame. And inside the frame is what's really real. So with all the doubt and all the debate, all we can agree on is real are the things that we can see and hear and smell and touch and control. The imminent frame. That's a secular view of the world. And I think that's the kind of story we just default live in when we work. So that's the philosopher. How about an artifact? I want to show you a picture from Fiverr's latest campaign. Can we see it? Have you seen this on the subway? It says, "In doers we trust." So Fiverr it's basically an electronic marketplace where people who need services find people, are connected with people who offer services. And in January, they launched this campaign, "In doers we trust." Sounds a lot like another phrase, doesn't it? In God we trust. And it's kind of like a slap in the face to say, well, we don't really need to trust in God because, well, that's, you know, waiting for God, praying. We trust in doers. In fact, another phrase that they published in a lot of their advertising, and I quote, is, "We get shit done. That's what we're about. That's what we're about. In doers we trust." And they're an equal opportunity offender. They also say, you know, basically dreamers are a waste of time too. They do a bunch of ads that compare themselves to dreamers, but this is it. I mean, this is the world that we live in. This is what's around us all the time. It's all about getting things done, and the best people in the world are the ones who produce the most results. And the way you produce results is you suck it up, and you lean into your talents, and you work your game, and you do it all on your own. You do it all on your own. So the story we inhabit at work is decidedly secular. And Taylor and Smith talk about how we got here. One of the ironic things that they mention is that the Christian church as an institution has in some ways accelerated this drive towards the secular. And they talk a lot about the Protestant Reformation and questioning everything and how that kind of leads to that kind of skepticism. But I wanted to share with you a quote from somebody who can just kind of shed a little bit of light on that. And her name is, Her name is Dorothy Sayers. She wrote an essay called Why Work? She was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis. So she was in middle age around the World War II. She was a British woman. And she wrote this really, really insightful essay. And this is what she says about work and the secular drift of society. She says, "And nothing has the church so lost her hold on reality as in her failure to understand and respect the secular vocation. She's allowed work and religion to become separate departments and is astonished to find that as a result, the secular work of the world is turned to purely selfish and destructive ends. And that the greater part of the world's intelligent workers have become irreligious, or at least uninterested in religion. But is it astonishing? How can anyone remain interested in a religion which seems to have no concern with nine-tenths of life? The church's approach to an intelligent carpenter, for instance, is usually confined to exhorting him not to be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very first demand of his religion is that he should make good tables. Church, by all means, decent forms of amusement, certainly, but what use is all that if in the very center of his life and occupation he is insulting God with bad carpentry? No crooked legs or ill-fitting drawers ever, I dare swear, came out of the carpenter's shop at Nazareth. Nor if they did, could anyone believe that they were made by the same hand that made the heaven and earth. And no piety in the worker will compensate for work that is not true to itself. For any work that is untrue to its own technique is a living lie." She has a lot more to say, but she shows how the first kind of issue in work is quality, and the quality is hooked into the story. So I want to move on from, you know, the dominant story that we work into a life-giving alternative story, and we're going to turn our attention to the Psalms that Moses read for us earlier. And what I want to suggest to you guys is that there are three themes in the Bible, three arcs, three threads where each of us is invited to work with God in the world, where our actual work that we do on a daily basis is not just something, it's not something we have to suffer through on our own, grind it out. It's something we can do with God in the world, that there's a with God nature. There's a with God part of it, and that it connects it to something that gives it meaning, and as we'll see in a little bit, it also gives it proportionality. It helps us stop when we need to stop. So what are the three themes? Creation, redemption, and provision. Creation, redemption, and provision. Probably most of your jobs actually touch on all three in one way or another. I'm just going to take them in turn, and we're going to think about how specific careers and industries even dial into them. So the first is creation, and right from the very beginning, we see God as this creator, this maker, this builder, who is dreaming up and bringing about. And so anytime we're taking raw materials and we're reorganizing them for greater benefit to others, anytime we're bringing out something new, we're being creative. And it says in the Psalm that unless the Lord builds a house, labor in vain. The author in Hebrews said that God is the builder of everything. Like, there's a creative energy of God, a creative activity of God that's in any good new thing that's being brought to the world. So you think about your job, and you think about, how does my job, things that maybe you could think about it in a macro way in terms of the industry or company and the service or product that you bring to the world, or you could think about it specifically in terms of the tasks that you do on a daily or weekly basis, but how's it creative? Where is there new? And for those of us in finance, there's always something new in finance, a new product, a new way to bundle investments. You know, there's always, sometimes the SEC doesn't like all the new things, but, you know, there's always something new, some better way to do it, and tremendous rewards for the people who figure that out. In the arts, we might say that, you know, there's no new story, but there's new ways to tell them, and there's new ways to capture our imaginations with the true stories of our journey in the world. And so, there's certainly in the media side of the arts, new ways to bring information, and lots of different opportunity and flux. And disruption, we usually use it as a negative word, but it's really about creativity and innovation. And it's creating with God in the world. In tech is all about new as well. Tech is always about figuring out where's there a pain point that we can reach in a new way. Where's design thinking is all about, we've got this problem and we've got to find a new way to solve it. And the best tech journeys seem to be an iterative loop where there's this ongoing learning process with, you know, between client and provider. And then if you're in any kind of service work at all, whether in service of a bigger whole or you're just directly caring for people or caring for customers, they appreciate it when you come up with a new and better way to serve them. You know, and whenever you do that, whenever you make that connection that there's an opportunity here for something new, you're being creative. You're not just being creative in the fact that, and the idea that, like, you copy God and you're like God and he's creative, but you're creating with him, co-creating. So think about your work that you do every day. How's it creative? How does it fit into that arc? The second arc is redemption. And it's in that idea that the sentries need to guard the city. They watch the city in vain if the Lord doesn't guard the city. Why does it need watched in the first place? You know, this is one of those places where, you know, I think we have a superior story because we have an explanation for why there's danger and risk and loss and pain in the world. And it has to do with sin. And Ryan talked about this last week. You know, sin is kind of the seductive force that wants to trick us into thinking that we can do life independent of God. And sin is that power that messes up the good things that God has given us. And marriage was first in line, as we saw last week. Work's right behind it in Genesis chapter 3. And the reason there's pain and loss and risk and danger in the world is because of sin. And sometimes we call that the fall in Christian thinking. So any work that mitigates the effects of the fall, any work that protects us from the effect of the fall, is joining God in something he's doing in the world. It's joining God in redemption. And many of you probably do work that does that. I mean, finance, we call it risk management. And so there's, you know, there's diversification and hedging and all kinds of insurance. And it, you know, it's got a title and it's all got to be done profitably, but it wouldn't be needed at all if there wasn't a fall. And art, you know, art gives us a space to deal with the brokenness of this world. And in the song "The Miracle" by U2, Bono sings in the chorus, he says, "I woke up at the moment when the miracle occurred to a song that made some sense out of this world." And that's what art does for us, that it takes the confusing and conflicting nature of the world and helps us make sense of it. There's a redemptive side to tech as well. I know people whose lives have been saved by the First Aid app and their iPhone. And we come up with there's a lot of other features that are particularly helpful for nervous helicopter parents. Figure out where your kids are. So there's this kind of redemptive side of that. And then in the service space, there's tons of ways where we find real needs and real suffering, and we either meet those needs, mitigate that suffering, or protect people from it. I mean, I think all of us are the beneficiaries, actually, of literally thousands of people who are protecting us right now. And they're joining God in a redemptive kind of work. So ask yourself, how's my work redemptive? How does it protect or mitigate against the effects of sin and the fall? And the third is provision. And it takes us to Psalm 104. And in those lines in the middle where it says, God has given us wine to make us glad and oil to make our faces shine and has given us bread to make us strong. You know, in the ancient world, oil, bread, and wine were kind of the staples of their diet. They were the basic things you needed to survive. And so on the one hand, you've got God saying, I've provided these things. And then as you reflect on it, you see that every single one comes from somebody's work. And wine doesn't drop out of the sky. I mean, there is an app that you can have it delivered to your apartment, but that's not the same thing. And olive oil takes a lot of work to produce. You have to cultivate the trees, and they have to get to the right maturity, and then you have to pick all the olives, and then they dice up the olives, and they put them in a press, and then they press out the oil and filter out all the sediment. And bread, Somebody grows the wheat, somebody harvests the wheat, somebody grinds the flour, somebody does all this work. And so here you have, these are like the staples. These are what we need to survive, and God has provided them through the work of others. So you can ask, you know, how does our work provide things that people need to survive in life? One of my friends works for Vanguard, which is where the Ropers do their college savings, and I remind him of that from time to time, because that's part of providing for our family. And he's in security, so he's part of protecting that. And he'll say, oh boy, I gotta make sure I do my job right. And I'll be like, yeah, you do, because it's part of provision for us. And so that's in the finance thread. In the art and media space, you know, art creates a space for us to celebrate, to reflect, to grieve. Good media gives us the truth we need to make decisions for our lives. I mean, it provides things that we need. And you know, you really can get your oil, bread, and wine with an app. It's called Seamless. And it works pretty well. And so there's just the basic things of life. Our tech is figuring out new ways to get them to us efficiently and well. And then many of us are probably in service places, we all are beneficiaries of service that gives us the stuff that we need, food and clothes and shelter and all those things. So most of our jobs probably connect with all three of these. They're creative, they're redemptive, and they provide. And when you start to think that way about your work, it hooks it into God's story. It reboots your imagination, and it gives it meaning that you can't find when you work on your own in the imminent frame. It also does something else, and it gives us the capacity to rest. And that's there at the end of Psalm 127. It says, it's in vain that you rise early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. For he, that's God, gives rest, or gives his beloved sleep. You don't have to work a gazillion hours to eat the bread of anxious toil. Whenever we work from fear, that's where it's coming from. The fear of failure, the fear of missing the right opportunity because we're committed to something else, the fear of financial struggle, the fear just of embarrassment. I mean, the truth is, there's a hierarchy, there's a class system, a caste system in the work world that some of us might even be embarrassed about what we do, especially in a very competitive space like New York. And it leads to anxious toil, to a stress-driven grind. And part of what he's saying is that when you start to work in a different story, when you start to see yourself and imagine yourself in God's narrative, you can sleep. You can sleep. And that's part of this. Part of this that I certainly need to hear and I wrestle with. And if you had a rough night sleeping, I'm not saying, you know, you're not one of God's beloved. But boy, if it's a pattern, you know, and you wake up with that hot feeling in the back of your neck and the hair standing up, and you're just thinking about, boy, I've got to get all this done. If I don't, it's all going to fall apart. Take a step back and say, what story am I working in? Because that to me, because I do it too, when I'm there, I'm working like I'm all alone and it's all to me. It's all to me. So God has a better story for us in our work. Creative, redemptive, provision. A story that changes the quality of work in terms of the meaning in it and our ability to rest. So I want to spend a few minutes closing with how we enter into the story. How do we switch stories? And there's two big ideas here. The first idea is that for a story to be yours, you have to experience it. You've got to experience it. And that's why these words from 1 Peter are so powerful. Is it really about how we enter in to a different story, a better story? He says, you know that God paid a ransom to save you from the empty life you inherited from your ancestors. And the ransom he paid was not mere gold or silver, it was the precious blood of Christ, the sinless, spotless Lamb of God. You got an empty way of life, and you needed to be ransomed out of it. And I think
we would, some of us anyway, would acknowledge that just kind of the way people work is empty. It's actually life is sucking a lot of the time. Tim Keller has been a pastor here in New York for 25 years. He said something recently that really surprised me because it was very, very extreme. He said he thinks the professional work culture of New York City is abusive. That's the word he used. Some people are laughing, some people are crying. If it was a different church, some of you would say amen. But that's what he said. He said, it's abusive. And that just, you know, sat up straight and listened to that, thought about that. But all of us have been handed down a way of life and a way of working. Some of it comes from the market, the industry you're in. Some of it comes from our families. Some of us, it's they're all the same. And if we do it on our own, it's always going to leave us empty. Always going to leave us empty. So Peter says, you've been ransomed. You've been rescued. There's a path out of that. But a price had to be paid. You know, we really believe here at LMCC there is a formal journey where you transfer stories. We celebrate it. And probably its most powerful symbolism is baptism. We celebrate it every week with communion. But there's something that has to happen where you consciously move from one story, the DIY, I'm on my own, it's all up to me story, to the story that's defined by the power and grace of God. And a price was paid to take us there. And that just kind of officially, formally moves us from one story to the other. So how do we switch stories? We've got to experience it. The second piece, though, is stories have to be told. Stories have to be told. We've got to tell them. And the first person you need to tell the story to is yourself. One of the things I love about New York is that you can talk to yourself and nobody will think anything of it. You don't even have to put your earbuds on and pretend you're on a call. It doesn't matter. Your boss is not going to tell you that your work hooks into the story of God's creativity, redemption, and provision. He never will. You have to bring your purpose with you to work. And, I mean, one of the things you could do is you could take this grid, creation, redemption, and provision. You could literally just do a little writing exercise and look at the work that your firm or organization does. See how it fits into those boxes. And then look at the work that you do all week and write it down. Then start to remind yourself, this is how what I do matters in this span of God's story and what he's doing in the world. Because nobody else can really do that for you and reinforce it on a regular basis. You got to tell the story to yourself. And then you need to tell the story to somebody else. You need to tell the story to somebody else, to share these stories with others, to find spaces where we talk about our work. And there's always going to be challenges with work, and there's always going to be frustrations, and we're always going to be considering opportunities. And that's all good to share, but we need to have these spaces where we just stop and say, this is why the work I do is really good. This is why it really matters. This is why I invest so much in it. And then we have a grid for doing that. I had three different conversations this past week with three different people who work in the city and doing three very different things. And it was so refreshing as they reflected on their own journeys to hear them talk about how they meet God in their work. And not in their work in a Christian organization or church, but their work out there in the world. There's a phrase that is in the Old Testament. It's from Jacob, who was a conniver and a swindler, a real striver. He would fit in well here in the city. And he says, God was here, but I didn't know it. And when we get to tell these stories with each other, I think we have this experience where we realize, God's really here. He's really with you at your work, and he's really doing something there. We just often don't know it, and we need each other to help see that. The third way we tell the story is we sing. We sing. You know, when I'm sitting where you are on Sunday morning, and sometimes it strikes me how different the world is as painted. How different a world is painted by the songs we sing on every Sunday morning. And so that world is really different than the world that I walk into when I leave. And the songs that we sing reinforce the alternative story. And the power of music is that it sticks with you. You know, the melody sticks with you. And the message can stick with you. And I wonder if some of us need to update the playlist we listen to on our commute. Because the quality of our work, the determined by the story we inhabit on the job, and God is offering us a better story. Let's pray. God, thank you that you care about the space in our lives that we all care so much about. And Lord, it feels overwhelming to try and figure out, like, how do we help everybody kind of move towards you in the space of work? There's so many different paths, so many different attitudes that we have towards our work, so many different kinds of spaces that each of us work in. But I ask that in your mercy, that you would meet each of us at work this week. And something would happen that would remind us that you're really there, that you're working there, and that you're working with us there. In Jesus' name, amen. Now we enter what we call a time of response. We have three options. One, you can just stay where you are and reflect on something that meant was meaningful to you, something to process from what we've just done together. You can also go for prayer. There are people in the back that will be happy to pray for you. It doesn't have to be about work, but it certainly can be. And then we're going to also offer communion, which is where we remember the broken body and the shed blood of Jesus. One of the things that Jesus said that I think was kind of a symbolic reference to communion, he said, "My flesh is real food and my blood is real drink." And I think he was saying, you know, this is the real sustenance you need for real life. And when we come to communion, we're physically acting out our surrender to him and the fact that he has paid for us to enter his story. So I invite you to respond as God leads you and the band leads us.